Washington, D.C. is no stranger to murder, but the city has never seen anything like this before. James Patterson's thriller Jack and Jill introduces us to a chilling game of assassination that targets America's elite, sending shockwaves through the Capitol's corridors of power. The novel, which became an instant bestseller upon its 1996 release, marked the second appearance of Patterson's now iconic detective Alex Cross, following the breakthrough success of Along Came a Spider. What makes this particular thriller so compelling is how it weaves together multiple murder investigations against the backdrop of a city divided by privilege and poverty. Patterson's work has been praised by Stephen King as addictively readable, and this particular installment shows why. It's a masterclass in maintaining tension across parallel storylines while delivering the psychological depth that has made Cross one of fiction's most enduring detectives. The novel opens with a meticulously crafted scene of premeditated murder. A man identifying himself as Sam Harrison methodically prepares to assassinate Senator Daniel Fitzpatrick in his upscale Georgetown residence. This isn't a simple assassination. It's the opening move in what the perpetrator ominously refers to as the game of Jack and Jill. The killer's careful attention to detail is evident in everything from his perfectly tailored Brooks Brothers suit to the specialized camera equipment he carries. When the senator's door opens, a sophisticated blonde woman greets him with the code word Jack, to which he responds Jill, revealing their carefully orchestrated partnership. The duo finds the senator in an inebriated state, making him an easy target as they handcuff him to his own bed. Jack executes him with clinical precision, two shots to the head from a silenced weapon, while filming the entire sequence. Their declaration that their exquisite game has begun carries heavy symbolism, as they view this murder as a commentary on America at the end of its century, suggesting deeper political motivations. Simultaneously, in the economically depressed southeast section of Washington, a very different predator operates with equally calculated but more sinister methods. Disguised as a homeless man, this killer transforms Garfield Park into a child's nightmare. He creates an enticing display of brightly colored balloons, red, yellow, and blue ones dancing in the autumn breeze, specifically designed to attract young victims. His patience pays off when 7-year-old Chanel Green, walking home from her grandmother's house, stops to admire the cheerful display. The contrast between the two crimes is deliberately stark and unsettling. While the media will soon explode with coverage of the senator's assassination, Chanel's disappearance will merit only a few paragraphs in the Metro section, highlighting the city's deeply rooted social and racial inequities. This parallel murder setup establishes the novel's fundamental tension, two investigations that will inevitably collide and compete for limited police resources and public attention. The Jack and Jill killings specifically target Washington's elite, politicians, media figures, and power brokers, creating immediate political pressure and media frenzy. Meanwhile, the child murders in southeast Washington, targeting the city's most vulnerable residents, struggle to generate the same urgency despite their horrific nature. Through this carefully constructed contrast, Patterson examines not just the twisted psychology of different types of killers, but also delivers a searing commentary on social inequality in American society. The author demonstrates how a single city can contain two entirely different worlds, one where every death commands national attention, and another where violence has become so commonplace that it barely registers beyond the immediate community. Detective Alex Cross is awakened at 3:30 a.m. by his partner John Sampson with news of Chanel Green's murder. After checking on his own children, Damon and Janny, Cross heads to investigate the crime scene just 4 blocks from his home. The proximity of the murder to his own residence underscores a key theme. For Cross, the line between professional and personal is constantly blurred. Unlike the political elite who can distance themselves from violence, Cross lives in the same community being terrorized. Cross and Samson spend the morning canvassing the neighborhood, hearing rumors of a child molester nicknamed Chop It Off Chucky. Cross is frustrated by the lack of police resources dedicated to Southeast DC, where children regularly disappear or are harmed with little official response. His grandmother, Nana Mama, is unusually shaken by the murder at Sojourner Truth School, urging Alex to catch the killer. The investigation leads them to Emmanuel Perez, a pizza restaurant porter with a distinctive red beard. When spotted, Perez flees, leading Cross and Samson on a chase through the projects and across rooftops. The pursuit ends tragically when Perez attempts to jump between buildings and falls 16 floors to his death. But the real Sojourner Truth School killer remains at large, as shown when he stalks a 5-year-old boy in a Toys R Us, introducing himself as Roger the Artful Dodger before nearly abducting him. Cross's dedication to solving these child murders is interrupted when Police Commissioner Clouser and Chief of Detectives Pittman arrive at his home with orders from very high places. The FBI has requested Cross for the Jack and Jill murder investigation due to his experience with psychotic killers. Despite his protests about abandoning the Southeast cases, Cross is forced to accept with a pointed question from Commissioner Clouser. Do you still want to be a cop? This moment crystallizes the novel's critique of how law enforcement priorities are determined by the victim's social status rather than the severity of the crimes. Cross finds himself caught between two high-stakes investigations, each demanding his full attention. His commitment to solving the Southeast murders, cases involving children from his own community, weighs heavily against the mounting pressure to focus on the Jack and Jill killings. The conflict intensifies after Senator Daniel Fitzpatrick's assassination, a murder that sends shockwaves through Washington's political establishment. The killing of television newswoman Natalie Shahan at the Jefferson Hotel marks Jack and Jill's next calculated move. Cross meticulously examines the elaborately staged crime scene where Shahan was found handcuffed to ornate brass bedposts. The killers left behind their signature cryptic notes, written in an educated hand with literary references that suggest extensive planning. Cross's psychological analysis points to perpetrators with possible narcissistic tendencies, evidenced by their theatrical crime scenes and need for public attention. The investigation takes an alarming turn when Secret Service agents lose track of President Thomas Burns during an unauthorized excursion. The president, codenamed Jack, slips away through a little-known White House tunnel system to meet someone in a distinctive red Jeep Cherokee. The agent's anxiety intensifies due to the disturbing parallel between their internal code names, Jack for the president and Jill for the first lady, and the killer's chosen monikers. As the Jeep disappears near the tidal basin's murky waters, the radio crackles with the heart-stopping message, "We've lost Jack," words that trigger immediate panic throughout the Secret Service ranks. During an emergency White House meeting, senior staff grapple with the terrifying implications. Chief of Staff Richard Hammerman outlines enhanced security measures, including severely restricted public appearances and additional protective details. The situation becomes even more dire when Secret Service agent Jay Grayer reveals the killer's pattern of contact. After each murder, they reach out to the Secret Service directly, taunting them with messages about practicing for the big one. These communications suggest a methodical approach to testing security responses and gathering intelligence about protective procedures. The investigation's complexity multiplies exponentially with the revelation that Jill, identified as Sarah Rosen, has infiltrated the White House staff. Her position provides unprecedented access to classified information, security protocols, and the daily movements of both the President and First Lady. This discovery transforms the case from an external threat to an insider conspiracy, forcing investigators to question every interaction and security measure within the White House itself. Rosen's presence inside the administration's inner circle represents not just a security breach, but a complete compromise of the protective systems designed to prevent exactly this type of threat. The novel introduces another lethal player in the deadly game, Kevin Hawkins, a prize-winning photojournalist whose extraordinary visual memory and attention to detail make him an exceptionally dangerous adversary. Though unremarkable in appearance, middle-aged, average height, with thinning brown hair, Hawkins possesses the rare ability to memorize complex visual details instantaneously, a skill that serves him equally well in both photography and assassination. Arriving in San Francisco under the guise of a tourist, Hawkins demonstrates his lethal expertise at the airport. With calculated precision, he executes a meticulously planned assassination of Mr. Tanaka, a high-ranking executive of the Nipray Corporation, using two carefully positioned suitcase bombs. The sophistication of the attack, timed explosions coordinated to create maximum chaos while ensuring his escape, reveals Hawkins as a master of his deadly craft. In the ensuing pandemonium, he slips away unnoticed, already focused on his next target in Washington, D.C., a mission bearing the ominous codename Jack and Jill. The gravity of the situation prompts an unprecedented meeting at the White House between Cross and President Thomas Burns. The president, a charismatic and trim 50-year-old former Ford Motor Company executive, won the presidency as an independent candidate, breaking the traditional two-party stronghold. His business acumen and outsider status made him particularly appealing to voters seeking change. During their tense meeting in the Oval Office, Burns dispenses with diplomatic niceties and asks Cross directly about the threat's credibility. Cross's confirmation that Jack and Jill matches the president's Secret Service code names sends a chill through the room. Drawing on his extensive profiling experience, Cross shares his detailed assessment with the president. He theorizes that the killers are likely attractive, white, highly intelligent individuals, possibly professionals in respected fields, who are methodically building towards something spectacular. Their careful planning and execution suggest military or intelligence backgrounds, making them particularly dangerous. The investigation takes a dark turn when Jack demonstrates his increasing audacity by committing his fourth murder without Jill's assistance. The target, General Aidan Cornwall, a decorated military strategist with ties to multiple classified operations, is eliminated with surgical precision. However, the mission goes horrifyingly awry when the general's 9-year-old son unexpectedly appears during the assassination. Jack's cold-blooded decision to eliminate this young witness reveals a chilling evolution in the killer's psychology, a willingness to cross moral lines that even hardened criminals hesitate to breach. This escalation signals not only Jack's growing boldness, but also hints at the killer's determination to eliminate any obstacles as they inch closer to their ultimate target. While the Jack and Jill investigation consumes Washington's attention, Cross and Sampson continue pursuing leads in the Sojourner Truth school murders. A breakthrough comes when Prodigy's interactive network discovers disturbing messages from a Washington, D.C. subscriber claiming responsibility for the child murders in Garfield Park. After the subscriber provides gory details only the D.C. police would know, they trace the account to Army Colonel Frank Moore's townhouse on Seward Square. When Cross and Sampson burst into the Moore's kitchen with weapons drawn, they discover the colonel and his wife are ordinary people shocked by the intrusion. When questioned about their Prodigy subscription, Moore explains it's for their 13-year-old son, Sumner, an honor student. Alarmed, the detectives insist on seeing the boy immediately, only to find his room empty with a note reading, "Nobody is gone," and Chanel Green's bloody blouse. The detectives realize the 13-year-old boy is the Truth School killer, now loose in Washington. This revelation, that a child is responsible for murdering other children, adds another disturbing layer to the novel's exploration of violence. The young killer is shown wandering M Street, disappointed that newspapers cover Jack and Jill, but nothing about his crimes, revealing his desire for recognition and fame. When he approaches the Sojourner Truth School during recess, he's confronted by the principal and ordered away. Before leaving, he spots Cross's son Damon in the playground, silently threatening the principal who challenged him. The Truth School Killer story takes an even darker turn when he hides in his own home's attic before descending at 4 a.m., the hour of the werewolf, to murder his foster parents. Overwhelmed with rage and sobbing uncontrollably, he fires 12 shots into their sleeping bodies, mimicking the Menendez murders. In a final shocking twist, Samson discovers that another murdered boy found in Garfield Park is Sumner Moore himself, the very suspect they've been hunting. The boy's body shows defensive wounds from fighting his killer, who beat him with something heavy like a lead pipe, leaving his face unrecognizable. As the investigations intensify, Cross meets with CIA agent Gene Sterling to share case information. They independently identify the same suspect, Kevin Hawkins, a professional killer already under CIA surveillance. Despite having only suspicions rather than concrete evidence, they decide to interview Hawkins, who's staying at his sister's house in Silver Spring. When they arrive, Hawkins spots them and flees on a motorcycle, leading to a wild suburban chase that ends with him escaping in a stolen car. Meanwhile, President Burns makes the controversial decision to return to business as usual despite the threats, refusing to let psychopaths completely alter our government. Despite his advisor's concerns, he insists on keeping his scheduled New York City visit, declaring, "Absolutely no regrets, no matter what happens." 9 days before Christmas, Alex travels with President Burns to New York. Despite security concerns, the president insists on taking a motorcade from LaGuardia into Manhattan rather than a helicopter, refusing to hide from Jack and Jill. The NYPD has deployed 5,000 officers for the president's protection, but Alex remains convinced that Kevin Hawkins is involved and dangerous. Kevin Hawkins, disguised as a photojournalist, watches the presidential motorcade at the Waldorf Astoria. He recognizes nearly everyone, including Jill, his psychopathic partner inside the president's circle. What Hawkins doesn't realize is that he, too, is being watched by Jack. After Hawkins disappears, Sam Harrison, Jack's real identity, makes a risky phone call to his daughter and wife in Maryland, revealing his double life. Despite his mission to assassinate President Burns, whom he considers a traitor, Harrison's family remains his emotional anchor. At the Waldorf, security is breached as Jack and Jill send a threatening flower delivery with another rhyme. Jack and Jill went up the hill and surprised the chief with flowers. "We're here in town, we're counting down your last remaining hours." Alex tells Jay Grayer that despite their kooky appearance, Jack and Jill know exactly what they're doing, and they're definitely in New York City. Throughout the novel, Cross grapples with the mounting psychological and emotional toll his work takes on his family life. The weight of his responsibilities as both a detective and a father creates an increasingly impossible balance. When he returns home late one night, exhausted from another grueling day on the case, he discovers someone has been making hang-up calls to his house. 12 calls between 8:30 and 10. The pattern suggests something more sinister than random pranks. Concerned this might be related to one of his cases or a potential threat, Alex and his partner Samson immediately arrange for comprehensive phone surveillance and round-the-clock police protection. Despite his bone-deep exhaustion, Alex forgoes sleep to spend a restless night on the porch with his service weapon, his mind cycling through worst-case scenarios. Every shadow and sound becomes a potential threat to his family's safety. The investigations have evolved into a relentless nightmare for Alex, leaving his stomach perpetually knotted with anxiety and wearing down not just him, but the entire Metro police force. The strain shows in their faces, their shortened tempers, their haunted eyes. Taking no chances with his family's safety, he keeps his young son Damon home from school with Nana and Detective Powell standing guard. The presence of the seasoned Detective Powell provides some comfort, but Alex can't shake the gnawing worry about 13-year-old suspect Sumner Moore still being at large. Though he seriously considers moving his family to his aunt's house in a safer neighborhood, Alex ultimately decides against it. He knows Nana would never willingly leave their Fifth Street home, a place that represents decades of family history and memories she'd fight fiercely to protect. In these dark times, Cross finds precious moments of normalcy and comfort in his deepening relationship with Kristen Johnson, the accomplished principal of Sojourner Truth School. Their connection grows through late-night conversations, both of them fighting their own battles with insomnia. They discuss everything from the challenges at her school, where Alex's son attends, to Alex's passion for piano playing, a talent that surprises and intrigues Christine. These personal moments with Christine provide a vital counterbalance to the darkness Cross confronts daily in his work. Their developing relationship offers him glimpses of hope for a future beyond the violence and a reminder that life contains beauty as well as brutality. Through Christine, Alex begins to imagine a world where he might find both justice and joy, though the path to that future remains treacherous. The climax builds as President Burns makes his public appearance in New York despite the threat. Alex studies the president's detailed 89-page itinerary while contemplating how Jack and Jill might strike. Despite massive security, nearly 1,000 plainclothes agents at Madison Square Garden, Cross believes the assassins will attempt something up close with an escape plan. The President and First Lady, holding hands, are escorted to an armored limousine in the Waldorf's underground garage, avoiding the planned public cordon. Cross feels overwhelmed by the number of suspects in the plot against Thomas Burns and the limitations of what he can do as a DC cop. He's eventually suspended from the police force for striking his superior, Chief George Pittman, during a confrontation over the investigation. Late one night, he sits on his sun porch with Rosie the cat, his mind haunted by human monsters. He eventually turns to his piano for solace, playing Stardust and Body and Soul. A knock at the door interrupts his playing. Gun in hand, he answers to find Christine Johnson, whose visit instantly brightens his mood. They go inside together to his home, where there are still rules and everybody is safe and the Dragon Slayer is alive and well. On Christmas Eve, while decorating the tree with Damon and Janie, Cross receives a chilling call from Gary Sonagy, a brilliant murderer from his past who had kidnapped two children and escaped prison twice. Sonagy claims to have been born again, but reveals a disturbing truth. He was the one who left Rosie the cat for Cross's family, proving he had been inside their home. He threatens that he'll be seeing you soon before hanging up. Cross returns to his children and their Christmas tree, knowing this isn't truly the end. Patterson's Jack and Jill masterfully explores the precarious balance between order and chaos in modern society, revealing how our carefully constructed sense of security can be dismantled by determined individuals pursuing their own warped visions of justice. Through the lens of Alex Cross, we witness both the professional dedication required to confront evil and the devastating personal costs. Strained relationships with his children, sleepless nights haunted by cases, and an increasingly complicated romance with Jesse Flanagan. The psychological toll of immersing oneself in the minds of killers leaves lasting scars that Cross carries throughout his career. The parallel investigations, one targeting Washington's elite and another involving murdered children in poor neighborhoods, starkly illuminate America's deeply rooted social divisions. When prominent figures become victims, the full force of law enforcement mobilizes instantly, with resources, media attention, and political pressure driving the investigation. Meanwhile, crimes in marginalized communities often languish, highlighting a justice system that appears to value certain lives more than others. Patterson weaves these contrasting narratives together with precision, forcing readers to confront uncomfortable truths about institutional bias and societal priorities. The novel delves deep into the psychology of both hunters and hunted. Cross's methodical approach to profiling reveals how killers like Sonagy think, plan, and justify their actions. The cat-and-mouse game becomes increasingly personal, with each side trying to anticipate the other's moves in a deadly chess match where innocent lives hang in the balance. The investigation reveals how thin the veneer of civilization truly is, how quickly social order can unravel when fear takes hold. The book's conclusion, with its ominous suggestion of Soneji's continued threat, serves as a powerful reminder that evil never truly rests. It merely adapts and evolves. For Alex Cross, the modern-day dragon slayer, each solved case brings not closure, but the knowledge that other predators wait in the shadows. This ongoing struggle reflects a larger truth about law enforcement and society. The fight for justice is not a finite game with clear winners and losers, but an endless vigil requiring constant vigilance, sacrifice, and dedication. Patterson's narrative transcends the conventional thriller format by examining deeper questions about justice, privilege, and moral responsibility in a world where security is increasingly illusory. The story resonates beyond its final pages, leaving readers to ponder their own assumptions about safety, justice, and the true cost of maintaining order in an inherently chaotic world.